Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Thanks for being loyal listeners after all these years. Our guest today is John Koenig, author of The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, published by Simon & Schuster. It'll be released on November 16th and will then be on our front table and in our front window. So try that if you're around. Otherwise, you can get it on Amazon or any other bookseller. So John's a video maker, a graphic designer, a voiceover artist. His work has been acclaimed by New York Magazine, The Washington Post, The Huffington Post, and many others. You know, the dictionary, as many of you know, this dictionary of obscure sorrows has a website and a YouTube channel that's been online for some years now. It coins and defines neologisms, new words generally for emotions that have no words to describe them. Although the title implies sadness, and it actually does cover a lot of that, sorrow is more spaciously defined by John, and I'll let him do that, as something that actually encompasses much more. Perhaps the most famous word he has coined is sonder, which has become semi-ubiquitous. Its meaning basically is that everyone who passes you on the street, enters your office or shop, sees you at a cocktail party or convention, is living a life as vivid and complex as yours. It touches on solipsism, as well as does a substantial portion of this book, which will be interesting. So you can begin the dictionary anywhere, just like any other dictionary, and flip through the pages, and maybe the best way to access the work. Plus, there's lots of evocative illustrations that go along with each of the six sections of the dictionary and epigraphs that accompany many. It's not alphabetical, but neither is life. And although you may not use these words in your quotidian existence, they at least, some of them, will stay with you and help you cope with emotions that you otherwise could not define, if you will, in more than the most abstract of whirling and conceptual blurs in your mind. So welcome, John, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam. I'm happy to be here.
So I guess the first thing, which it's not important, I guess, it's important. How many people over the years have sent you their neologisms?
Thousands. Yeah, and I think that's actually one of the more satisfying things about this project is the sense that I'm not alone. You know, people, as I go about my day, I get emails from hundreds of people describing just really raw and sometimes ridiculous and sometimes really just minor observations of what goes on through their heads throughout the day. And so to me, it's a really vivid reminder of, you mentioned sonder, you know, the rich universe that's happening inside the heads of everyone around us. And so that I get emails from them describing what's going on it's a privilege.
That reminds me, like, I've interviewed like six men and women over the past couple of years that have written books about the seat of human consciousness. And generally they're scientists or neurophysicists or biologists. And I always ask them, what if we actually lived in a solipsistic universe? Which generally gets them pissed off because it screws up their theories completely. And if we do, then only one of us is talking. And you do touch on solipsism in a couple, or maybe even more than a couple of the definitions. What do you think about that concept?
I think it's our, if anything, it's kind of our natural state. You know, we have to think of ourselves as the main character and everything else kind of fades into the background and revolves around us. I can't speak to the physics or the metaphysics of the concept, but for me, I think it's what you have to do to get by in the world. You have to, you know, treat people like distant objects in a certain way. So, you know, for me, language is a big part of that as well, because the way we use language is, I think, influences how we think, and language encourages us to be reductive, to reduce people to the roles they play in our lives. And so we have to continually, if we do it right, remind ourselves that there is an entire universe going on, you know, bottomless complexity beneath each of these you know, every word is so simple and has such a clean and crisp definition, but beneath that, there's a thicket of complications. And so I think what I try to do with this book is sort of remind people of the sheer complexity that's carrying on around them.
Well, actually, since I'm a bookseller, the cover and epigraphs are things that people look at.
Sure.
And in addition to the first one, which is great, I know you thought about all of them, but I think the most relevant one is the one, and it's a long one, is David Foster Wallace, who's my hero. Yeah. And that touches on solipsism too, but it does that we thing, you know, the we slash thing. It gives you an idea, okay, I'm talking about solipsism, but I know it's just me thinking about, I don't know, ego-related things.
Yeah.
And that was a really good explanation. Better, I guess, than you or I could even do.
Oh, totally. That's why I did such a long quote at the beginning, because I can't introduce the concept any better than DFW. So, yeah.
I know. And I even put the abbreviation on my notes here. Yeah, I miss him. Yeah, Girl with Curious Hair. I think that probably was the first book I read, and The Broom of the System.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So Stephen Wright, who I saw last year in New Jersey, he still did the same material, though.
If it ain't broke, appropriate. You know.
So tell that one.
Oh, sure. The page one of the book is a quote from Stephen Wright in which he says, "I read the dictionary. I thought it was a poem about everything." And so that was just so perfect with what I've tried to do with this book. Just sort of, you know, just open up the aperture and just take it all in and try to find patterns in there, while also being, you know, acknowledging how silly that goal is.
Try to keep a sense of humor
throughout.
Do you agree with me that you can pick the book up anywhere, or am I wrong?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I deliberately didn't put it in alphabetical order, because I always view that as a kind of progress bar. Granted, not many people read the dictionary the way I do, I guess, but it spills out sort of at random, but it is divided into six themes, sort of addressing different mysteries that we all face.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the standard definition of definition, it's the idea, it's a statement of the exact meaning of a word. Mm-hmm. And here's where maybe it is a kind of confusion, because these words that you've essentially invented and derived as a portmanteau from other languages, they're not defined in the normal sense of definition, because they're much, in a good way, somewhat more nebulous, and it gives the reader room not only to remember or think of what they're feeling right now, but I think it gives them a little room to expand upon it as well. Just like you said, the contributors, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I flip through a traditional dictionary, I'd say you just get the sense that everything has already been explored, and, you know, things have their tendencies, and a finch is a finch and a schooner is a schooner, and everything is pretty neat and buttoned up. But with mine, I tried to put a crack in that and just remind people how open-ended that life can be.
You're in Minnesota, so you don't know this store. It's called Wawa, and it's a silly name, but it's a convenience store. But it's a really well-run store, and they have double doors. So when you walk in, you open the door for someone, and they say thanks. Or they open the door for you, and you say thanks. So when you go into the store, you feel like, this is good. I just shared a moment with humanity. And that's like your word, Zeno.
Right, right.
And it's totally, they don't need to have double doors. There's no reason for it.
Yeah.
And it just creates that moment, which makes you more of a consumer, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I define Zeno as the smallest measurable unit of human connection. So all these little tiny interactions that we have every day, but less during the COVID era, can really, I don't know, they can be fulfilling in a way, even though they're not, you know, formally meaningful. But yeah, that's a kind of connection that I think a lot of us are missing right now. But certainly I miss it, and I look forward to it coming back eventually.
This morning, my wife and I walked our dog, and there's like this narrow bridge. So everyone, we pull to the side with our dog, and everyone goes mm-hmm. by, and everybody waves to us, and we wave to them. And that's exactly the same thing, too.
Yes.
It's just acknowledging, yeah, I exist. I'm good. You exist. You're good, too, because you just did me a favor.
Yeah. And
so that word really resonated with me because it does. And, it, you know, the same thing with the bookstore. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there are larger moments, but it's the same thing.
Yeah. It can be a touch point, you know, between passing strangers, and you can recommend the books you love to people you've never seen before and will never see again. Yeah, it reminds me of another one of my words is hailbound, is mysteriously compelled to wave to strangers on a, you know, a stretch of remote road or a river or something. I think that specific mood is sort of spread in the COVID era, where we're just like, you know, we're just happy to see each other. And there's something special about that still.
Oh yeah, it's true. It's like when everyone in New York got out on their porches and banged their pots and pans at one time.
Yeah.
But then there's a couple words that like you think they're bad at first, because like canker sore mm-hmm. or heartworm is yeah. like, you know, what is this going to mean? And yet they aren't. And so the reader has to say, oh, this isn't what I thought, you know? Those were good ones too. So define those if you remember. I mean,
I'm going to try. One of the hardest things about this is that I've been working on this book for 12 years. And so a lot of these words were named something else completely differently 2 years ago. So I have to remind myself, like, did I redefine that one? Anyway, so heartworm is a relationship or a friendship that you can't get out of your head. That's just sort of, you know, coursing through your mind like a forest fire, you know, that hops up from a spark in a leftover campfire. And then hankersore is similar, but it's finding someone so attractive it actually kind of pisses you off.
What's the one word that, like, maybe you just mentioned it? It's the one where you have eye contact for just a moment and you know there's something there, and then like the movie Sliding Doors, that's the end of it. I forgot what that is.
Yeah, I think there's one called Opia that's more of an essay that is about the fleeting intensity of eye contact and how you can kind of get a peek into the vault, but in the end it's just a passing glance.
Oh yeah, in the beginning of each section you should tell the readers that you know you go on into a narrative of what things are going to be about, and it's not a definition, I guess it's prefatory to what you're going to find inside. And those were very valuable, I thought.
Yeah. Some of them, because those essays sort of grew out of the YouTube videos that I've been making. And so they're much more, I'd say, lyrical more than anything else, just sort of soaking in some of the moments that seem to have more complexity to them. And so those are very special needs, like onism, you know, the awareness of how little of the world you'll experience. Or yu-yi, the longing to feel things intensely again the way you did when you were a kid. A lot of those, I can just sort of sit indefinitely and sort of soak in some of those emotions. But others are just sort of kind of a passing thought that I stop and recognize and define a little bit and then move on.
Some of the words kind of pissed me off because I've lived like twice as long as you. So the words that suggest that you don't have much time left.
Oh, yeah.
They may be written for you, but I'm going, shit, he's like at 5:30 and I'm at 11:45. You know, it's like, oh, God damn.
But the point of the definition is the not knowing, you know, like yeah. I could, you know, last year I had open heart surgery. Before that I was a picture of, you know, health. I'm in my mid 30s and suddenly I was, you know, going to the hospital in a COVID time, just trying to make my way through that. But there's no telling, but that's a lot of what gives each moment its, its punch. Is the not knowing. So if it's up to me, I think we should soak in the not knowing.
Yeah. So,
ambiguity.
Easy to say.
Yes. That's, I speak from a position of privilege, but you know.
It's funny, I ramble and I go off on tangents, but I was just thinking when I was writing these notes up for the interview, spell check.
Oh, spell check
caught every word. And it was just really funny. The only ones, the one that I said was semi-ubiquitous and holds a place in your heart and in the book is Sonder. And then I was looking it up on the web and there's this hotel company called Sonder.
It's like a billion-dollar corporation.
I know.
Big deal.
I'm thinking, should they pay you? But then I looked and in one language, it's racing yachts. In German, it means wonder. In French, it means to plumb. Mm-hmm. In Afrikaans, it means without. You know, so yeah, that's really interesting to me too, because I'm not picking on you, but there's lots of words like that.
Yeah.
That are going to look at the English language is replete with them, that it's all contextual.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I often try to hit words that, you know, that certainly do have the red underline in Microsoft Word. This word doesn't exist. And so that's, for me, that's a shot of confidence that, like, okay, there's no one who's tread this ground before. But obviously, I mean, language is so rich across the world that you're going to find a lot of, you know, a lot of parallels and things like that. But I try not to worry too much about that because, you know, there's language is open-ended. So for me, a lot of the parallels are just, you know, ripe for interestingness and debate, certainly. In particular, Sonder, some people have written in sort of offended because in German, Sonder means special. And so Sonder commandos were Nazi, special Nazi troops. Not that they were special, but they were designated as such. And so they thought that I was sort of muddying the waters there. And something that was really horrifying in history shouldn't be played with like that. But my response was, is that this sort of thing happens all the time where the Nazis appropriated swastikas, which it had existed for thousands of years before them. But I don't think it's up to us to defer to the monsters of history if they use language the way the rest of us do. I think it's, you know, to keep language alive, we have to keep playing with it and keep challenging it and keep redefining it, even if it forces us to have conversations about, you know, whether I refer to soldiers or whether I refer to an emotion.
Yeah, I know words, especially right now, we're in this concept of cancel culture, if you will. I mean, there was this city council guy in Washington, D.C., a really stupid guy, and he used the word niggardly, simply means stingy.
Yeah.
But he had to resign.
Wow.
Because it's similar to another word. And that's, yeah, that's exactly what happened with you. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. But the good part is I was able to have a back and forth with them, you know, about language and about how we use it. And I think, you know, ultimately it was a very interesting discussion and I think we both learned from it. So that's the best case scenario out of that kind of discussion. But I think that's a lot of what doesn't happen these days and didn't happen in the example you cited is that people, you know, stop listening once they hear certain words. And I think we have to keep listening.
And that's what's happening in America. People don't listen. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
If you listen, then there would be civil discourse. So show the cover of the book because sure. I always forget.
Yeah, so I just got the it's only in hardcover and audiobook. I designed the cover and I did the audio.
Oh, you did? So, they never let authors design covers.
Well, they presented me with a slate of five options and I gave them a sixth and they took it. So
it's a really great cover and I've said this in every show, but it's because I own a bookstore. But, you know, people say, well, it's another expression. You can't judge a book by its cover. But every single person who comes into my bookstore, without exception, does that, unless they're looking for a specific book.
Yeah.
So this is a great cover because, well, you can't see it because of the bird.
I can hold it. That's fine.
Yeah. It's a great cover because it implies, well, the cover is like one of your words, really, because to a person who's coming into the store, the cover is basically like the outside of a jigsaw puzzle box. You know, the pieces are inside, but, you know, it's just a representation. Yeah, so the cover is evocative. So yeah. What does it mean?
Evocative is a great term. It means a couple things, I think. One, Sonder is really important to this project. And in the definition of Sonder, I refer to how it feels like each of us is the sun in our own solar system. But, you know, in the background, there are billions and trillions of other stars, each of which have their own systems. And we're all, you know, co-stars in that way. Nobody is an extra. We're all the main character in our own story. So that was already in my mind. But in the last section of the book is sort of a commentary on just random thoughts about language, uninformed or otherwise. And I compare what a word is to basically constellations, where, you know, it doesn't have to mean anything other than what it is. It can be useful to navigate for some people, but for others, you know, it's this made up thing that that doesn't necessarily correspond with the real world. It's almost semi-mythical. And so when people think about whether a word is real, which is a topic that I've confronted for over a decade now, as people ask me, like, are these words real? I would say they're real in the sense that a constellation is real. It's up to us whether we want to take them seriously or use them to navigate. And so with the star field is really just an open-ended, symbol of open-endedness, where we can connect the dots however we want.
Well, the thing that you can't see, at least in this video, is the fact that there's almost like in a Japanese picture where Mount Fuji is paramount and there's like a little guy in the corner. There's always a little guy. There's two ships.
Yeah.
And they're like two ships that pass in the night in one sense, or not even aware of each other's existence. So that was cool too.
Yeah. I'm stitched together a couple engravings from an astronomy, two different astronomy textbooks in the 1890s. And so I chopped them up in Photoshop, but something about it spoke to me. Also, they seem so well lit, apparently just by the stars, which is, I don't know, there's some magic going on there.
Exactly. Well, that's the other thing is that, okay, here's this picture, and that's what it is. It's a picture. It's not a word. So picture tell worth 1,000 words. So do you expect, or have you ever expected, and once again, not to beat a dead horse, but Sonder is the perfect word. Did you ever expect that any of these would actually enter English parlance or be in Webster's? Or do you think they should be? Or do you think people ought to use these, as I said, in their day-to-day existence? Does it matter?
I've generally tried to be sort of agnostic about that question because, you know, a language, if it's done right, it can be yours, you know, it can be meaningful to you. And so I don't think that a word is only worth knowing if it helps facilitate communication between people. And so, you know, in the introduction, I say that this book is not necessarily intended to add to the language or to be used in day-to-day conversations. It's enough that it exists, that it can be a touch point to help organize your own thoughts or feel like less of a stranger in the wilderness of your own head. And so I think that's, you know, if it creeps its way into other dictionaries, which would be amusing, I think that'd be fine with me. But also if they just stand on their own and then people recognize them and move on, maybe they resonate. Maybe they don't. I'm sure there are definitions in here that potentially I'm the only one who has ever felt, but that's part of the problem. Part of the challenge of writing a book like this is that I'm just speaking from my own experience, and a dictionary is sort of a mockery of the idea that we all live in one objective universal reality. But in fact, we're just hemmed in by our own subjectivity all the time. And so I confront that subjectivity quite often in this project.
Yeah, that's why I always go back to the concept of solipsism. One, because I'm obsessed with it, and I might be obsessed with it without anybody else even knowing it or being around. That's why I'm obsessed with why one is not a prime number, which goes to lexicon too. But I think it should be a prime number because it's divisible by one. And it's also divisible by itself. I look at that as being two different things. And I've talked I've interviewed mathematicians. Oh, one guy who was a Nobel Prize winner, I asked him, why is one not a prime number? And he goes, wouldn't be convenient. Hmm. So
it's a fascinating thing about interviewing, and you're lucky to be able to do it, but interviewing experts in their fields is they'll tell you how just sort of cobble together a lot of our conceptual frameworks are, you know.
Exactly.
If you talk to a biologist or a taxonomist and ask them what a species is, they'll be like, you know, it's not a simple thing. Like, everyone assumes it's one thing, but it's actually just an assumption. It's something that we made up just to help facilitate our conversations. I assume primes are similar in that sort of way.
Yeah, and some of them are mildly offended. It's like, if you have a cold and you go to a brain surgeon, he's going to want to open your skin. He's going to want to go in there. Yeah. And that's how a lot of these guys are, but they can't look. It's science, so they don't have the ability to look at it subjectively. Hmm. And, oh, that reminds me. Hmm. I'm glad I thought of this. The word that a lot of people know, Schadenfreude, mm-hmm. is a good nomen for the entire book, because in English, there isn't anything other than explaining how you feel. But in German, it's like, okay, this guy just went bankrupt. I'm kind of happy that he went bankrupt.
Right. Pleasure in other people's pain. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a lot of words in your dictionary that we've adopted that word because we can't think of one of our own. That's basically what you've done. Mm. That feeling is, I can only express it. And you just expressed it in the same sentence rather than in one word. And I think that's what, yeah. Like the one about the eye contact. Yeah. I always explain this when I was in an airport once, and I just happened to turn around, and I was like 16 or 17. And there was this beautiful girl, and she was looking directly at me. Mm-hmm. And then we walked like another 100 feet, and then we turned around at the same time, and we were both looking at each other. And I thought I should do something, but I didn't. And that was it. But I could never explain that in a word, and a really short word too.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of my words are derived from other languages, borrowed or stolen or cobbled together. And a lot of the reason for that is just like with Schadenfreude in German, or, you know, Duende or Ubuntu or so many of these really amazing words, is that once you know them, they expand your awareness a little bit. Just in on the one hand, they're shortcuts that just allow us to do the same thing that we could do with a full sentence. But they affect how you look at things. I grew up in Geneva, Switzerland, just surrounded by tons of different languages going on all around me, from Africa or, you know, Asia, or French, which is the primary language over there. And so I was just always confronted by how many different ways there are to look at the world. I think the same fascination that you feel about solipsism is just, you know, it's about perspective and how varied it can be and unique to each person. And so I think that's what foreign languages represent to me. And it's just sort of, there's so many different ways to look at the world. Let's explore some of them. Let's challenge the lenses that we typically grab, because they're right in our little cases. But yeah, we can also, you know, grind our own lenses and look at the world in brand new ways.
Yeah, and I could tell you that your book is derivative, but like, that sounds perhaps pejorative, but it's not, because look at Latin. I mean, I thought of a word, you know, because you think ars longa vita brevis, mm-hmm. you know, which basically means, hey, this beautiful stuff's going to be here and I'm going to be gone. So yeah. I thought of like a word that would make you afraid of that, which would be vita brevissima, but it would be totally borrowed. But right. It would give you, because it's IA at the end, it would give you this idea of the feeling that, oh shit, you know, this beautiful porcelain vase is going to be here and I'm not going to be here to see it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that would be kind of good.
Yeah. Like, that's the first essay in this book, actually, is Vemodalen, is the feeling that, you know, originality is no longer possible. And I confront that all the time, you know, even in, you know, some of these words already mean something else, but I think they're so beautiful that I'm going to go forward anyway. Or some of these ideas, like the feeling of transience, you know, the bittersweetness of knowing that everything is transient. That's the last essay of the book. that has been addressed countless times all throughout history. And I called it Tiris. There are many other names for it. In Japanese, Mono no Aware is the term for it. But I thought I'd have a crack at it myself. It's I think it's healthy to add to the conversation that way. And it's just a conversation. I think, you know, especially in languages, there's often nothing new under the sun. So let's just enjoy ourselves.
That's true. It's like, you know, like Newton or Einstein would say, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Right, exactly.
And then the other interesting thing, speaking of the way you borrow and the way I would borrow, is like then you turn some concepts on their head, like modus ponens, like in that last section. What is it called? I forgot.
So there's a legal term, notus tollens, which is, but I changed the first letter of that into notus tollens, which is, I think it literally means the knot that denies by denying or something like that. But originally it was meant, if P, then Q, but Q is not, therefore P must be, must not be. But I defined notus tollens as sort of similar to that in that, you know, you're unsure, you no longer understand the story that you're living, that there are too many events that don't seem to cohere together. And so you have to go back and sort of sift through how you got to where your life is and try to make sense of it. I think that's a big part of living. That's a big part of why we're so obsessed with memory and nostalgia is, you know, it can be a source of just trying to weave it all into a story. And it doesn't have to be real even, but it can be a comfort.
Yeah. I was just thinking, yeah, you're right. It's like, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. That's modus ponens.
Mm-hmm.
And now I don't even know why, but that reminds me of your book, but I don't know why it reminds me of it.
I think the tension between collectives and individuals, maybe. I address that a lot too.
You're exactly right. Yeah. And that goes, you know, yeah, it all goes round and round. And whether it's solipsism or derived terms, yeah, it all goes round and round. And basically, I think it's because you're really, really aware that you're living in your head.
Yeah.
You know, when did you start thinking that?
What a question. I've never been anyone else, so I can't speak to whether I'm unique in this respect or not. But yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
I was like six or something when I went, like, I still wake up like going, what the hell is this? You know,
yeah.
Like that. There should be a word for that. What the hell is this?
Yeah, right. One quirk about me is that I just love the feeling of existential crisis. So a lot of my definitions, I think, have just, you know, installed just a little bit of that here and there. And so, and again, perception is a big part of that. But I think when you confront how flawed your senses are, and you get used to that with optical illusions and with, you know, misremembering things in earlier in your life, and someone comes along and says, that's not what happened at all. And you have to be like, oh, okay. But then that is the foundation that you build your entire life. All your relationships all are filtered through your senses. And so whatever flaws of perception are built in, you know, that's your existence is threatened right there. It's complicated in ways that we can't really, I don't know. It's tough to manage that uncertainty.
And none of us are any different in that way. We don't remember what happened. We just remember what we remember. And then we remember what we remember we remember. And
yeah.
Time it gets more dissonance. The other epigraph that I thought was really cool was the one by Milos. And the end of it is what really got to me, because he goes, there's too much. There's too much in the world. And it reminded me of Sartre's nausea, because, and I really connected with this, because at the very end of it, it's like, he is nauseous, the title of the book, because there's just, it's too much. And it's not that it's disgusting, but there's just too much stuff to like have around.
Yeah.
And I don't think nausea is the right word for it. I think it should, but I don't know if it was translated properly or not. Maybe there's a different word that should be used. But yeah, why did you include that?
I think
you have it. Do you have it in front of you? You want me to read it?
Oh, or
do you
sure. Have it? Yeah, I can. I'd love to read it. I think that's one of my favorite as
me
well.
Too.
It's right at the beginning of the first chapter, called "Between Living and Dreaming: Seeing the World as It Is and the World as It Could Be." So it's about perception and the world you live in, and the fantasies that are interwoven with that perception. But so this is from the separate notebooks, just an excerpt of a poem. The bright side of the planet moves toward darkness, and the cities are falling asleep, each in its hour. And for me, now as then, it is too much. There is too much world. And I think that's really at the heart of almost every other definition in the book, is the sense that you're only just scratching the surface of things. You know, all your memories and experiences of the past are just a tiny sampling of the whole, and even that deeply flawed. Even your relationships with other people, no matter how well you know someone, it's a tenuous connection built on our shared understandings of words that could mean something totally different. When I say I love you and I hear that back, it's anybody's question as to whether we've actually, you know, shared our feelings there. And so, you know, the sense that there is a hidden enormity all around us that we're only just scratching the surface of, I think is just, it's on every page of this book.
Yeah. A lot of it is what I did in the dorm room with a conversation at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was in college.
Mm-hmm. I love those conversations. I miss those conversations.
So do I. Yeah. You know, they don't happen anymore. There's only a certain time in your life where you can talk about the cosmic type of things. And that's the other thing about this book, is that sometimes I think, oh, is this like meta? Is it magical realism? And then I thought, where the hell am I going to put this book in my bookstore? Do I put it with dictionaries? What is the genre? Where am I supposed to put it? You know, you tell me.
That's a good question. Yeah. I got, you know, the galley back from Simon & Schuster, I was curious to know how they would sort of classify it. And it's done quite well in the Amazon charts for lexicography, which is fair, I guess. You know, it's about language and about some of the theory of that. But to me, it's also just so much more, like just philosophy. It could be emotion. It could just, kind of a memoir without details in a way. But
yeah, maybe philosophy would be the best. I don't know. Can't put it in fiction.
Yeah.
Can't put it in nonfiction.
Right.
I can't put it in science fiction.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just put it in one of the alphabetical sections. Yeah. No, I think I'll put it in philosophy.
All right. I like that. That's great. I love that.
But if it's on the front table, that's where it's funny, because that's the curated part, which is I'm doing what you do.
Yeah.
I'm curating it, you know, so I'm putting it where I think it belongs, where I think I would be saying something about it.
Yeah. It's a huge curation is so important to, I don't know, culture these days and just our day-to-day lives. But the tension to me within and between categories is something that I think about a lot about too, is that we obsess about categories and how to classify things while not actually talking about the substance of the thing itself. You know, I've heard more commentary about whether Die Hard is a Christmas movie, or whether Pluto is a planet, or whether, you know, Batman is a superhero. Like there's so many of these debates that are not actually about anything other than, you know, here's the constellation of ideas as it exists in my head. And does this star fit in it or doesn't it? So that, you know, hopefully some things can still just sort of stand on their own and be undefinable.
I just got this card from somebody I interviewed, and he goes, "Time has passed since we had that spirited interview. Nevertheless, it's not too late to say thank you." But we must have had an argument, and I don't know who it's from because I threw away the envelope, but it says, "Buddha has a saying, people with opinions just go around bothering each other." And I thought, that's pretty much what you just said.
Yeah,
there was one more question I was going to ask you that I thought was important, but now I forgot. Yeah, it's the idea that, I don't know. Oh, I know what it was. It's as basic as, you know, I see this is an orange, but it is also orange. And I have no idea, you know, this is another dorm room thing. I have no idea if you see the same orange as I do, and I never will.
Exactly.
And a good portion of the book is, I think. Oh, that's the other thing. I end up talking more than the internet. It's ridiculous.
It's a great conversation. We're right there in the dorm floor. It's fantastic.
Yeah, you're right. We are. Yeah, it's just a question of, by, you know, you do these definitions, but you don't know. Oh, yeah, that's the question. So the reader, but whether it's YouTube or whether it's your website, and each week if you add a word, do you expect the reader to come away with what you imagined it to be? Like I ask authors, you know, who write a novel, does a reader have the right to interpret this the way he or she wants to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the longer I've worked on this book, the more open-ended it has been, you know, from the reader's perspective. My initial vision of this was much longer sort of introductory sections that was a little bit more prescriptive to, you know, in dictionary speak or didactic, or, you know, here's my thoughts about the passage of time or something like that. But I just kept spinning those off into definitions. And then I was just left with the epigraph. Just let them say their beautiful little nugget of mystery, and then move on. And I think, you know, I've gotten much more judicious with the editorial scalpel, and I think my editors have helped with this too, is that I don't always have to explain things. I probably do already too much in this book, but there's something to be said for just raising a topic and then letting, you know, and then stepping back and letting the reader find their own meaning in it. So
I really enjoyed the narratives at the beginning of each part. I thought they were really good. I don't know. The book is accessible, but the narratives give you more of a key to what's going to be inside. I thought they were really good. And then the other thing is, like I said earlier, because I'm a bookseller again, is the epigraphs I always find fascinating because you're well-read and you gave a great deal of thought to what those would be. As a matter of fact, and then I'll let you go. Two last things, what Boats Against the Current. So you thought of Gatsby.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then I thought, well, why is he thinking that? And then I realized that one of the words, or more than one of the words, is, you know, you can try as hard as you want, but you just can't win, you know?
Yeah, the key word there is against, I think, is that time flows in one direction and we're fighting to, you know, we can see where we've been, but not where we're going. That's a line in the book. And that's a, you know, a big limiting factor of perception of time. That I think about a lot is that, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could know in advance, you know, a lot of our experiences, and then we'd actually be able to navigate time as it is. But
yeah, so
go backwards.
That one word, two things. So there's one word that starts out and you think it's going to be really sad, but then basically it comes down to, you know what? You can still enjoy every single moment. I can't remember the word, but there's one like that. And then the other thing is that you start off, well, look, you got a title that people are going to think it's a really sad book, but you, like I said, some of the definitions are sad, but talk about the broader definition that you give us right away.
Sure.
In the introduction of what sorrow is.
I think that's actually the first definition that I go into in the book is a sort of redefinition of sadness. Because originally, you know, for as useful as etymology can be in revealing meaning, in some ways it's also just sort of trivia. But sadness originally meant fullness. And so I think, you know, instead of viewing that particular emotion as sort of a malfunction in the joy machine, we could also view it as just sort of like you are filled to the brim with some intensity of experience. And that is certainly worth cherishing. And it's not necessarily good or necessarily bad. It means that you are alive, that something has managed to, you know, to make you feel something and to get under your skin despite yourself. And the way I'm wired, whenever I find something that makes me feel truly sad, I feel really lucky. And I find joy, you know, interwoven with the grief. And so a lot of people over the years have asked me, like, would you ever consider writing a dictionary of obscure joys? Which I think is a kind of interesting question. But when I try to imagine what that would be, I think it would actually be a really sad book because, you know, if you just read descriptions of like, oh, it was a perfect day and the sky was crystal clear and, you know, my grandmother was still alive and my dog was there and with me and I wasn't fighting with my partner so much. And suddenly all this context that makes it joyful would just kind of leaven every, you know, not, it would weigh everything down. So I think in the one of the last sections of the book, I talk about how you really can't have one without the other. And if you try to, something would kind of be out of whack there.
Yeah, and so it's like
a lot of these are joys, really.
Yeah, it's like yin and yang.
Yeah.
And then the thing that's great about yin and yang is there's an element of each and the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
All right. I promise this is the last question. So at the end, you go a word of advice and you do Ali Ali Oxen Free, which has all kinds of, you know, it's hard to figure out where that came from. But then I thought, why is that a word of advice? So tell me.
That's a great question. Yeah. So I think that's just about the last word in the book. And to me, it means it's almost a note to self, is that my general mode in my life that leans a little bit too strongly towards self-protection, of hiding my emotions. And, you know, being a man is certainly a part of that, I think, in this culture. So it's sort of a note to self to come out of hiding, which is the origin of the term in the kids' game of hide and seek. But I think there's something really beautiful in the idea of it's okay, come out of hiding, the game is over. And so we can now all meet in the middle somewhere and be present with each other and not hide in our own corners, and we can stop playing games.
Yeah. And I, as the reader, just looked at it like, you're safe now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. That was good.
Great.
Good ending. Well, thanks so much. It's, you know, you have to admit it's a unique book, and there's nothing better for, again, a bookstore to have in it. So, yeah. So
this has been a fantastic conversation. I thank you for it.
I feel so too. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Right. Thanks so much.
Bye.